This meeting of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have a number of bills related to disability issues, but we'll start out with Senator Erickson Ropes with the Medical Assistance Drug Formulary Committee bill that got laid over from last time. File 378.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. It's great to be before you again with another good bill. I'm joined today by Sue Everholden with the from the NAMI organization, and Dr. Euchre, who is a psychiatrist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Plans to testify today, and we have some concerns about the drug formulary committee makeup. That has been causing some concerns or need for improvement in terms of the view of the mental health community. So we'd like to put those before you today. And I would like to have Ms. Everholden walk you through the bill and describe what's going on.
Ms. Everholden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Everholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness. Last week we had Mary Graves here, who is actually the consumer member of the committee, but she was not able to take off of work and come back today, so I'm kind of testifying in her behalf. And again, she serves on the Drug Formulary Committee. The Department of Human Services monitors the use and cost of medications by people who receive medical assistance through basically two major activities. And these activities seek to decrease the total cost of medication spent through Minnesota's health care programs and to monitor quality through analyzing dosages and combinations. The two programs are the Drug Formulary Committee and the Drug Utilization Committee. NAMI has always advocated that people with mental illnesses should have open access to medications. It can take a while to find the right medication, dosage levels, and combinations of medications that alleviate symptoms and help people recover. Limiting access can greatly harm these efforts. Any efforts to restrict access to medication should be done through an open and transparent process with adequate notice and time to respond. The current Drug Formulary Committee has no term limits, and there's no process in place to notify the public when there are openings. Mary Graves applied because I happen to know the previous consumer representative who told me in the hallway that she was resigning, and so Mary simply emailed in her resume and letter and was accepted. The committee is required to hold a public forum when deciding which drugs will require prior authorization and to have a 15-day comment period, but there's no provisions for notifying the public of their proposals. There's no email listserv, so people who are interested in attending a meeting or finding out what happens have to actually check the website continually for any notices. I happened to look last week, and there was only one set of minutes that had been posted for all of 2008. Also this year, the Drug Formulary Committee adopted a meeting policy pertaining to public comments. All comments are to be made in the first hour of the meeting before the committee actually discusses what's on the agenda. People are only provided 3 minutes, and if there are more than 20 people who wish to comment, everyone's time is reduced. People have to sign up to speak before the meeting starts, so you have to arrive at least 10 minutes early, find the sign, and put your name on it. I think, frankly, this just doesn't make sense. How can people comment before they hear what is being discussed? The Drug Utilization Review Committee actually met in August of 2007, where they set limits as to the dosage and quantity of antipsychotics. The agenda contained no such information, and afterwards we asked mental health advocacy community and providers if anyone knew that this was going to happen, and they all said no. Also last summer, the Drug Formulary Committee voted to require prior authorization for a new way to deliver an antipsychotic. Mary, who serves on the committee, was opposed because, as was NAMI, because she knows how helpful it can be in terms of medication treatment adherence to be able to use it in a way that is convenient and makes sense. If you think of all the different ways that you can take, for instance, calcium, you know, you understand. Some people take it once a month. I personally like to take it once a day. When I had the once a month, I actually never took it for 6 months. And so getting it in a different dosage and different types of delivery can help in terms of treatment adherence. I think if you, in looking at the bill, Really, all we've done is make sure that the commissioner has to provide a notice of vacancies, post an application for appointment to the committee, and then after reviewing the applications and receiving input, then make the appointments. We would add a clinical researcher, so it's not just people finding things off the internet, but someone who really understands how research is made. We think there should be at least three consumer representatives so that they're not the only one. Anytime Mary actually agreed with the psychiatrist on the committee, they just said, oh, well, she's just obviously going to agree with the psychiatrist, instead of recognizing that people who have family experiences or, you know, individual experiences with this actually can come to the table with their own opinions. It just may differ from what the department's is. The other thing that we did is we did limit their terms, so they can serve two terms. But, you know, again, at some point, you should go off of these committees. And then making sure that the meeting notices and the drugs to be considered are conspicuously posted on the department's website at least 14 days prior to a meeting. If you were to try yourself to go and find out what drugs were going to be considered at the next meeting, I guarantee you that you will have a difficult time finding that notice. We also said that prior authorization wouldn't be required for medications used to treat mental illness if there's no generic, and that if the drug provides a new method of delivery, longevity, or dosage. One thing that we know, and Maine found this out as well, is that when you require prior authorization, the consumer doesn't find out until the point of sale. So they may get a medication, you know, prescribed by a physician, and they don't find out that it requires prior authorization until they get to the pharmacy window. And as you can imagine, if this is a drug that you were not really keen on taking in the first place, or you have transportation problems, you know, that type of thing, you actually may not come back and get that prescription filled. Maine actually found that out, that it cost them more to require prior authorization in terms of administrative costs versus the cost of people not getting their medication. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Uecker.
Chairman Marty, members of the committee, I'm Jonathan Uecker. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Psychiatric Society. And I'd like to specifically talk about the proposed amendments in Section 2, Subdivision 13F. And I'd like to frame my thoughts on the proposed amendments in terms of increased access to what would be hopefully the best possible medication for an individual patient, as opposed to the very costly issue of medication noncompliance. I'd also like to preface my comments by saying that while I think psychotropic medications are an important modality in the treatment of mental illness, the longer I practice, the more I realize that true recovery really comes from the hard work of psychologists, the therapists, the social workers, caseworkers, and advocates who work with mentally ill persons. The rate of medication noncompliance in individuals with mental illness is around 42%, which is almost twice the rate of noncompliance observed in individuals being treated for physical health conditions, which is around 24%. The reasons for noncompliance can include the person's inability to recognize that they are mentally ill and in need of medications, embarrassment about taking psychiatric medicines, the side effects of certain medications, and whether a drug is immediately available at the pharmacy. The most common reason why a medication is not immediately available at the pharmacy is that it requires a prior authorization, which can often take several days, if not a week. If a medication is not immediately available, then there is a known increased risk that the individual is not going to return to the pharmacy to pick up medication, and this is particularly true with individuals with chronic and persistent mental illness who often have problems accessing transportation. The logic follows then if there are significant delays in starting the medication or if the medication is never started by the patient, that there is an increased risk of morbidity and subsequent increase in healthcare costs, especially if that leads to hospitalization. From the perspective of patients, many of the newer medications have fewer side effects, which is also a known factor in improving compliance. There are a number of compelling studies that show that newer psychotropic medicines, when compared to older medicines, decrease the need for rehospitalization, not necessarily because of superior efficacy, but because patients were less likely to stop the medications because of fewer side effects. It also should be noted that psychotropic medicines are not interchangeable. For example, It's not uncommon to see someone who has failed on three what we call serotonin reuptake inhibitors, antidepressants, but has responded well to a fourth medication. And this type of phenomenon is not unique to psychiatry. We see this in other classes of drugs, such as antihypertensive medicines and oral diabetic medications. Finally, it's been my experience that many individuals participating in MA have severe illness and mental illness and have already failed on a number of generic medications, which often leaves only brand-name drugs as the only option. I guess, you know, more thoughts about noncompliance and why it is an issue is that by making medicines more readily accessible, I believe that that actually decreases the cost of care. Major depression is now the leading cause of disability in the United States and perhaps in the world. 20 million people in the U.S. have, and I'm just talking about major depression here, not all the other mental illnesses, have been diagnosed with depression, and the direct and indirect costs are estimated about $44 billion. This cost, however, pales in comparison to the cost of medication noncompliance in the United States, which is approximately $300 billion in unnecessary health care costs. A final cost that I think you need to consider is that with access and noncompliance is one that can't be easily calculated, and that is the disruption of lives when medications aren't readily available to patients.
So, Mr. Chair, just to summarize, our bill does basically three things. One is it increases the transparency of the function of the committee, and it adds more consumer representatives and then a clinical researcher to that committee. And then the last thing it does is steps away from prior authorization for treating mental illnesses where there's not a generic available or if there's a new method of delivery for a medication. And I'll just summarize by saying I think all of us can relate to the obstacle that people run into. If we were to have a doctor's appointment this afternoon, you have to take time off of work, go sit in a waiting room for a while, get to see your doctor, go through your appointment, get a prescription, move on to the pharmacy, and then wait for your prescription to be filled, only to go up to the counter and then have to, the pharmacist say, well, you need prior authorization from this from your insurance company, and you go home with no meds. Well, you can't go back to the doctor's office that day because you're already finished with your appointment. It means you have to take another day off of work, and if you're dealing with some major psychiatric illnesses, we have transportation problems, somebody took the day off to get you to the doctor's appointment and to the pharmacy today, you're stuck. And I think just this really puts up another barrier for access to medications.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, you say that as a remainder of the committee members are to be made up of healthcare or mental health care professionals. That doesn't make any guarantee that anyone is going to be a mental health professional. Is that the intent? Just that they can make sure they are allowed to put somebody on who's a mental health professional, or you wanted to make sure they were?
I think the language being in the bill would suggest that they need to include someone that's in mental health, although it is not a requirement, because there are many different advocacy groups on medication, but we would really like them to include or be cognizant of the need to have someone from mental health available. And additionally, we do think a clinical researcher that brings a very neutral research-based position and perspective to the committee would be key.
I understand the clinical researcher, but you are also explicitly saying that one has to be that. I just wonder, because I think we like to think of mental health care as part of health care, and if you're distinguishing it, if you wanted to specify that one, I don't know how many of the remainder consists of.
Mr. Chair, is that your recommendation that we specifically indicate?
Your bill, I'm just saying that if you're saying this might make it be that the appointment is that, I think mental health drugs are a significantly big part of it that you might want to. But
I'm sure the Mental Health Alliance would be happy if we would include a designation specifying at least one of the members be from the mental health community.
Senate Counsel. you know. Okay, well, wait a second. Discussion from committee members. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson Ropes, I don't know how many other committees this needs to go to, but it would need to go to the Finance Committee in the end.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson. Senator Torres, right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking that in order to ensure that, we might just need to change the word or and just say and. And that way it will ensure that we will have an appointment of mental health professionals.
Yep.
Council, if they could advise on that.
Okay. Senator Erickson Ropes moves to strike the word or and insert the word and on line 18.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Line 18.
Is there any discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill. Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? If not, Senator Erickson Ropes moves Senate File 378 as amended be reckoned passed and referred to the Committee on Finance. Have you heard from anyone else that needed to see it?
Not that I know.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gore, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've got Senate File 854, a disability transformation bill. The state's current financial crisis really does exacerbate the long-term unsustainability of medical assistance funding for our long-term care network, and this bill is an attempt to lay the groundwork to eliminate unneeded mandates and replace them with a set of single standards that can help providers maintain safe and quality services and protect this state resource that we have with these folks. This is in conjunction with the state embraced goal to make services quality and outcome-based and consumer-driven as well as cost-effective. I've got Bruce Nelson and Barb Jacobson, both from ARM, who have been working very hard on this and have been engaging many of the stakeholders, and we will continue to do so as we move this bill forward. I do believe it has a few policy stops and will, as it's currently drafted, need to go to finance as well. So this is a work in progress, but there's a number of really important reforms that can help with the long-term stability of our long-term care industry. So with that, I'll let Bruce talk a little bit about the path we've been on and some of the provisions in the bill, and I'll listen myself, and if we miss a few, I can cover them at the end and try to summarize.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Senator Lurie. In your packet, I believe, is a draft report, draft for discussion, and we definitely mean, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. And just to back up for a second, ARM is an association of about 150 providers employing about 27,000 caregivers who work in the various waivers, ICFCMR, and our members employ about 27,000 caregivers. The reason we put together this draft for discussion, and as Senator Lurie indicated, those discussions will not continue around the bill we've drafted. Minnesota, I firmly believe, and you should all be very proud, has one of the most wonderful systems of support in the nation for people with disabilities. Much of the system started being built about 25 years ago, and it addressed people basically coming out of institutions and moving into home and community-based settings. But things have changed, and people no longer are coming out of institutions. They're growing up with mom and dad, and sometimes staying with mom and dad, as we'll hear later today, much longer than is perhaps desirable for everybody. So those things have changed. And then as we looked at the world, the broader world last summer, we saw really, if you don't mind the metaphor, a couple sets of stars. We saw a lot of dark stars lining up. On the federal level, Medicaid expenditure is going to double in the next 10 years to over $700 billion. Within that expenditure, about the enrollment for people who are elderly, people with disabilities, is about 26%, but the expenditure for those folks out of all that Medicaid money is about 70%. This is not sustainable. We recognize that. And on top of that, we've got baby boomers who are going to be adding to the burden. I'm a baby boomer and in my 60s and might be lining up for services in a little while. People with disabilities, it's a wonderful thing. They're living a lot longer than they used to. People with Down syndrome, for example, 20 years ago had a life expectancy of 25 years. Now it's about 55 years. And as they get older, their needs go up. We have waiting lists, as we're going to hear about. And obviously, we have a staggering, stunning deficit that you folks, hopefully we'll all in partnership, be addressing. On the bright side, we in Minnesota and the disability community have been looking at ways to move our system, from some of the archaic stuff that was built 25 years ago to a system that really is centered around the person, that is focused more on quality outcomes than bureaucratic outcomes. And we can be, and we will be, and we have to be more cost-effective, and that's what this bill is all about. It's to move us in the direction of consumer-centered, quality-focused, and to find ways to be more cost-effective. Now, we can't do all of this overnight, and we realize that. There are elements in the bill that will try to address some of the things in the short term, as you can see in the report and in the bill, some short-term things that we can do right now. There are also some interim steps that we can take to lead to a longer-term resolution. What our vision is, and we will have continuing discussion with all of the players, is a single set of standards that meet the criteria that I'm talking about being consumer-centered and being cost-effective. In putting the bill together, in putting the plan together for discussion, we typically do, started with what are a set of principles that we can all agree on, that we can build from. And I'm going to turn it over to Barb Jacobson, who is our chief operating officer at ARM, who will walk you through on page 4 of the plan, principles that go back, that were agreed to in the disability community in 1999. And Barb?
Thank you. I'm Barb Jacobson with ARM. And back in 1999, there was a steering committee for system redesign, and they developed a set of principles that we revisited and in looking at those, determined that they are still a strong set of principles. Although some of the wording may need a little updating for the way we speak of people today, the concepts are still good and still strong. And so as we look to build our system of reform, we come back to these because there was a large stakeholder group, many people still in the business, who agree to these things, and we feel they're still good and still important, and I want to walk you through them briefly. First of all, the relationship principle. Most important, people should be able to plan with and be supported by those people who know them and care about them. Control, authority, and responsibility. Again, people should have control over and authority and responsibility for the resources they receive. The equity principle, people with similar needs should have equal access to similar financial resources, regardless of their situations. Flexibility principle, people are able to creatively design their supports in ways that best meet their needs. Health and safety principle, health and safety parameters are created within a context of reasonable risk and responsibility. Simplicity principle. Rules, regs, and funding streams are understandable to those who receive the supports from the service system and not duplicated, replicated, or incompatible with each other. And accessible information principle. Those rules, regulations, and funding streams should be able to be understood by the people who receive services. When we look to develop what we hope is going to be a simple set of standards for people receiving services, these are the principles we want to keep coming back to. And if you'll notice, the word people and the people receiving services are the primary focus in each of these principles, and that's going to be our primary focus as we go to redesign or reform the system, making sure that the people who receive services are the priority, the first priority. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I better step folks through the bill. There are a lot of provisions, and I think it's really good to have gone over the guiding principles because I think most of these provisions do adhere in oftentimes in many ways to those guiding principles. So Section 1 is a provision where a provider licensed in a county may serve three or fewer persons in another county without applying for an additional license in that subsidiary service area that they're that they might like to work in or be required to work in, actually, to serve their population. Section 2 basically allows for technology for overnight supervision in adult foster care homes when it is determined to be effective by the interdisciplinary team and the individual's residential placement agreement. Section 3 makes human services background studies conducted on certain classes valid for 60 days and requires that the study be accepted by any licensed program. Section 4 deletes the requirement that after a licensed program has submitted a background study request, there's a current requirement that the program has to contact DHS if the program hasn't received a response from the commissioner within 45 days. I think that we should keep the burden on DHS rather than passing the buck after 45 days. DHS agrees to, I believe. Section 5 deletes the requirement that DHS contracts with intermediate care facilities for persons with developmental disabilities must include a quality improvement plan. This is also going to be a DHS recommendation when they come forward. Sections 6, 7, and 8 actually delete an obsolete rule reference, Rule 53. Section 9 requires that the expert panel convened by DHS in 2008 make recommendations on ensuring the stability of the intermediate care facility system and maintaining these services as a viable service option. That would kind of continue efforts that are already underway. Section 10 deletes the requirement that intermediate care facilities report quarterly to the local county on the use of variable rate funds and the status of the person on whose behalf the funds were approved. These reports are not used. This will also be a DHS recommendation. This section also allows variable rates for new admissions when the variable rate leaves the overall system costs unchanged or results in a cost savings. Again, trying to better utilize our expenditures. Section 11 is really an incentive to move to less costly services when appropriate for the individual's needs. It allows recipients of waived services to relocate to services without 24-hour supervision and receive the equivalent of the recipient's GRH allocations as a Minnesota Supplemental Assistance Shelter Needy payment under certain conditions. Section 12 requires DHS in collaboration with Minnesota Department of Health and other interested parties to develop a report on a single set of standards governing services for persons with disabilities. This would be to replace existing laws and rules. Section 13 requires DHS to complete development of a common service menu for waivered services, regardless of which waiver a client is being served under. Section 14 is a blank appropriation for the COMPASS program that the governor also recommended in his pages. And Section 15 are a couple of repealers. The first one is repealing requirements to intermediate care facilities occupancy data. These are no longer used these are no longer used. DHS is going to be recommending that as well. And the second one is currently physician assistant statements are required for staff who work in homes licensed only as adult foster care, but they're not for those licensed under adult foster care and 245B. This bill would make those requirements for physician statements consistent for these two programs. So that is a summary of the bill. Bruce and Barb kind of set up why we started working on this, and we would take any questions.
Questions from the committee? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, I just wanted to commend you for working on this as much as you have, and just wanted to relate a story to you that I think it will be relevant and that you really need to review before moving forward, and that's in relationship to Section 12, which is establishing the single set of standards. The Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections and 87 counties had to work on a similar provision to create standards for placement and really look at how they look at placement of children. And they created what they call at the time the umbrella rule, and it took about 7.5 years to come up with recommendations that I believe left everybody in the same place. I do not believe that there was significant improvement in the way they conduct assessments and do work in terms of placement. I sincerely hope that this will not be the case with this type of issue, because we really need to be more creative. The times really demand that we do better work in all of these areas, and this is something that we really need in this area in particular. So I don't know, I don't have right now a recommendation, but I really encourage you to look at that model and to learn from it, because I do believe that we're going to need stronger language in terms of defining kind of a time frame and defining really more specific outcomes in terms of what you want to see coming out of this report and the action that you want this specific agencies to take on this regard. I am just telling you, I participated on that, and I think it's very important that you take a look at that and incorporate language here to make sure that they follow through on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions or discussion from the committee? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Senator Lori, I have my comment is that I think this represents some good work, and I would encourage you as you move forward with this, to the extent possible. It strikes me that some of the sections in this bill you may be able to move forward with little or, in fact, perhaps even a savings, although it's sometimes hard for us to capture those. But if you the extent to which you can identify clearly before you move to your next committee which items have fiscal implications, I think that that would be helpful. And my question is, you know, in my district we have done quite a bit of work actually with the Region 10 Quality Council, and I wondered if they were, if some of the things that were happening in Region 10 are reflected in this, or if you see this as how this might interconnect with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, we didn't specifically reference Region 10, but we've worked with Region 10. We're well aware of many of the great things that have come out of Region 10. And as we develop a set of standards that's more focused on quality outcomes, on being consumer-directed, it's my intent and our association's intent to look very closely at what's worked with in Region 10, what can be extrapolated from that to a statewide set of standards, and to move forward with that. So I know the governor has proposes to eliminate the Region 10 commission in his budget. We would oppose that. We think it is a model that we can build from.
Senator Gore.
And Mr. Chair, I guess I will reply as well. Yes, we're going to be very fiscally sensitive as we move forward with this bill. The one piece that we do, of course, know is the blank appropriations for the comprehensive assessment, and that'll come, you know, at least that'll come before the Finance Committee, and we'll be tracking that. I think that it is a pretty good proposal to be moving forward, and as part of a package, I think the whole thing should be able to save money, but we will be working with DHS as they craft a fiscal note for the entire package, and we'll look at each individual piece. But that's the only one at this point that we believe should result in any state costs. But we will find out.
Further discussion? Mr. Nelson.
If I might add, Mr. Chair, the reason we put this in there, we're very sensitive, obviously, to trying to save money rather than spend new money. But we see this as one of the two linchpins to making this work. One of them is the interdisciplinary teams, and the other is a mechanism to get us out of the current silos we're now in, to get people into the appropriate kinds of service so they're not overserved or underserved, and we're using our dollars more effectively. So while this is an upfront appropriation, we think that down the road, this will lead to a much more cost-effective system, and that's why we chose to, although we wanted to avoid fiscal notes, we did put it in the bill.
Is there any further discussion? Is there anybody in the audience who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? Senator Gore, have you had any requests from other committees for the bill?
I don't have any specific requests. I think it's going to need to go to
local government,
at least local, state and local government for the reporting, and we'll take a good look at Torres Ray's concerns and try to strengthen that as much as can be, because I'm also concerned about making sure that the reports actually provide us something of use in a timely fashion. But I don't know of any other.
Okay. Senator Gore moves that Senate File 854 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Corey.
I would just say that, Senator Loria, when you go to state and local government, make sure you have your ducks in a row, because I went there and it was you know what I'm talking about.
I live there, so yes. Particularly bad.
We're going to take up Senate File 711 next, because Senator Sharon is apparently presenting a bill in another committee right now.
Next in the agenda, we have Senate File 711, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 711 deals with TEFRA law. This is the procedure in which we have parents who have children who receive services for disabilities in their home, for parents who receive medical assistance, to contribute to the cost of that care. And I think very few states do require this, but Minnesota does. And 2003, in the budget balancing bill, the TEFRA payments of parents went up sometimes as much as 700%, a massive increase. We lowered them a little bit in 2005, but it's still a heavy burden. And this legislation would simply say that if the child lives with the parent, the parental contribution is reduced by $100 per month. And it also would say that that if people get reimbursement for this through the health savings account, health savings flex accounts that people get under Chapter 125, that the parent may be responsible for paying taxes owed on the amount reimbursed. And legal Services Advocacy Project pointed out some changes we needed to make, and I have the A1 amendment, which is a technical amendment. It's in your packets. And I will move that amendment right now.
Ed. Thank you. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. Any questions from members? If not, all of those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, the argument for this bill is, again, that a lot of states don't charge parents for paying part of the extra costs of their children's medical assistance. But the reason that this is particularly burdensome is many parents of children with disabilities, DHS did a study that showed that 2/3 of them don't take jobs or take lower-paying jobs in order to provide care for their children, and so they have lower income, and this is very high expenses. One of my constituents said that her current parental fee is 39% higher than their income taxes, and we've heard there's a letter in your packets, I believe, from a woman who talks about how she and her husband had a parental fee of $737 a month. And a couple of years ago, when her spouse lost his job, they had to take out a loan to provide care for their kids. And they took out an $11,000 loan. And trying to work more overtime to pay off the loan doesn't help a lot because the TEFRA payment goes up as their income goes up. I do have three people to testify on the bill. Lori Pickert, Deb Howley, and Tim Casemodel. And if you want to come forward now for the testimony.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Lori Pickert. My husband and I have two children and live in Lionel Lakes. We created our family through international adoption, and we embarked on this journey with great zeal to work and commit ourselves to the children, very similar as we did to our education and careers. We could have never imagined the tumultuous course our first child's disability would take us on over the last 9 years. We knew there were risks that he could have issues, so for months we prepared. When we chose him, little did we understand how deep the scars of pre- and postnatal trauma, institutional care, neglect, and poor early development would be. Quickly, my full-time job became to remediate what could be and find supports required to thrive and not endure any more institutional time. After many years of privately funded endeavors and very few gains, many setbacks, we had no choice but to learn how to reach out to a greater public system which we never knew existed. Our son's primary disabilities are neurobiological in nature, and for over 9 years, we have visited all types of specialists for medical treatment, rule-out diagnosis, utilized all types of therapies for emotional issues, employed therapeutic parenting, endured aggressive episodes, navigated 5 school different placements. The list goes on. He's required line-of-sight supervision his entire life. I've been unable to return to the workforce due to his instability, and our typically developing daughter has missed out on many typical experiences. Up until 2 years ago, all his services were funded through private insurance and parental funds. MA funding began just 2 years ago, services under the CADI waiver program just 9 months ago, and he finally received a county mental health social worker just 15 months ago. Because of MA and waiver programming, our son has gained access to services and supports that extended beyond our personal efforts. But along with that programming comes a parental fee, and we agree we are not entitled to, nor do we expect free services that he requires. He's finally making slow and steady sustained progress, and this is in due part to the services of MA and CADI, but it has not come without great sacrifice. Due to the parental fee determination formula, our parental fee is our largest monthly expense. It is more than our mortgage and all utilities combined. And one example is a year ago we paid $800 per month, and now we pay almost $2,300 per month due to a one-time bonus on my husband's income. So today we're less financially secure than we were 2 years ago. We have stopped all saving for emergencies or anything in excess of my husband's 401k. And we've changed our lifestyle from being consistent savers for our future to living paycheck to paycheck to make sure we can pay our TEFRA bill. So the sliding scale for parental fees is becoming a disincentive for our son to remain on the programming. Our son requires various supports throughout his home and community life to continue to make progress and live inclusively. As the next fiscal year approaches, we will make the decision whether we continue to afford the parental fee and continue with services. But to stop that programming would be very short-sighted. It would lead to less supports, lower his quality of life, and eventually he would become a bigger burden to the state. But the reality is that as the parental fee gets proportionally higher, families must choose whether to pay the fee to continue programming or leave MA supports completely behind. So in conclusion, I ask that you seriously consider reducing parental fees so families that are working hard to pay their bills, be fiscally responsible, and find their children appropriate supports may continue their efforts without having to withdraw from services altogether. Please know that the financial stress and the child's disability puts us between a rock and a hard place. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have Deb Howley.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Deb Hawley. My husband, Kevin, and I have a son, Connor, who is 11 years old and is medically fragile. Connor is developmentally and cognitively delayed. He is nonverbal and non-ambulatory. His diagnosis is low-tone hypotonia and cerebral palsy. Our main message to convey to you today is how the parental fee has caused a financial crisis and a hardship to our family. We would like you to revisit the calculations of the parental fee program. My husband and I strive to better ourselves. We both work full-time positions. We have longevity in our positions and consistently go above and beyond what is expected. The TEFRA and developmental disability waiver does not create an incentive to financially better ourselves. We are being penalized with a fee to keep our medically fragile child at home. One piece of our story is that in December 2003, our son was 6 years old and had been hospitalized several times at Children's Gillette's Hospital for unconsolable abdominal distress and vomiting. This would go on for 5 to 7 days. I finally had to resign my position as a regional supervisor working for the same corporation for 23 years in order to provide appropriate care for our son. At the same time, he was growing older and bigger, and our son needed an accessible form of transportation. I could no longer lift him into our vehicle. Now I'm unemployed and in need of a handicapped van. We had a Windstar van. We found out that the companies who convert the vans do not convert Windstars. They can only convert the Dodge Caravan with a longer wheelbase. Therefore, we couldn't afford a new car, so we borrowed from our retirement to purchase the vehicle that they could convert. The amount for the van was then calculated as part of our total gross income that year, and our parental fee went from $300 a month to $1,100 a month. Additionally, we were penalized for early withdrawal from your retirement account and incurred additional income tax debt. On top of that, we now owe the state $11,000. You not only suffer from the financial debt, but grieve and strive to keep our child alive and well each and every day. After that, our son went back to school. Within 2 months, I went back to work full time. The loss that I took was an 80% loss in my annual salary, increased costs in automobile insurance for a handicap accessible van, significant loss in family medical insurance, loss of optical and dental, and encumbered $11,000 debt to the state. Please do not allow a program like this with the current calculations. For an average income family, it causes us to financially suffer or to have to make a choice to be employed or to have to stay at home. We want to continue to work. Please make a change in the current calculations of parental fees to allow us to continue to keep our children at home. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have Tim Casemodel. And while he's coming up, I wanted to point out that in 2007 we had a similar bill, and the fiscal note from the department pointed out that they expected if we reduced the fees as much as that one did, that there'd be 500 additional families being served, meaning that people are obviously declining to get the services simply because they can't afford it. As Ms. Holly pointed out, she both had big loss of income and great increase in expenses all at the same time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Hello. My name is Tim Case Modell. My wife, Laura, was here 4 years ago to testify for a reduction in parental fees, at which that time we were grossly more than our federal income taxes. I was here 2 years ago to ask for a further reduction as the fees are still near or exceed our federal tax burden. Our son Thomas is just a wonderful little 11-year-old boy who, in addition to autism, has a long list of health concerns, motor skill impairments, and sensory integration issues. Early in life, he had many infections and hospitalizations. He is considered mentally retarded. Although he's 11, he functions as if he were less than 3 years old. Thomas is still wearing diapers, uses vocalizations instead of words, and requires 24-hour supervision. He has gastrointestinal issues that result in very aggressive behaviors when he is experiencing pain. When we consider out-of-home placement, that's one of our biggest concerns is I'm not sure he would even be able to be in a group home or anything like that. We received Thomas's diagnosis in December of 1999. At that time, we were the typical Minnesotans, two parents working full-time with two children, age 2 and 4, in daycare. Since Thomas's behaviors were too much for the daycare to handle, I had no choice but to give up my job to help care for my son. When we started working with Thomas, he was distant and completely mute. Today, with assistance that we pay through the waiver, we have established contact and a loving relationship with our son, Thomas. He engages us in play, is learning how to use a computer, and occasionally uses words. We are extremely grateful for the waiver. Thomas is, however, one of the most severely affected children with autism that we know. He has put his hands through the windows 5 times in the last 9 months, requiring stitches when he's having the painful issues. Why do we need a reduction in parental fees? In 2005, my wife testified that our parental fees were more than our federal taxes. There was some reduction of that year, of which we were grateful. However, our TEFRA fees, based on our 2006 tax return, were $3,288, while our federal taxes were $2,611. And our state taxes were $2,124. Our family out-of-pocket medical expenses not taken into account through the TEFRA formula were $14,000. Incidentally, our cost for parental fees in the last 7 years were over almost $28,000. Our most recent TEFRA calculation based on our 2007 taxes was $3,468, or a $180 increase. Why did our fees go up when our income was flat? Because our income went down as our expenses went up and we could no longer afford any IRA for my retirement. Since I wasn't working, we were putting in $2,000 out of our whatever we could save. Changing our adjusted gross income and our fees went up. Our 2008 parental fee will be even higher, even though our income again went down in 2008 because my wife had to forego most of her 401k contributions to make ends meet. I have also returned to work part-time because we are at risk of losing our home. In addition to federal taxes, we, like so many other parents on the waiver, have refinanced our home to pay for debt incurred prior to getting on the waiver, pay for damage to our home caused by Thomas that is not reimbursed by the waiver in excess of $75,000 in the last 9 years. I've basically given up patching holes in the drywall. And for medical treatments that are not covered by insurance or Medicaid. Many of the improvements in Thomas's health and behavior are the result of holistic and alternative medical care and thus not covered by any insurance. These out-of-pocket expenses can add up to thousands of dollars per year. We are trying to stay in our home of the past 14 years and maintain the waiver for our son. We realize that without a change to the parental fees, this may not be possible. If we continue to pay the fees and roll the money as debt, we will eventually have to move out of our home. We are currently exploring this option. However, with the way the TEFRA is set up, we're kind of confined. It's best if we stay in Hennepin County, so it's not like we can, you know, move out to a lower home-priced homes because we would lose the established relationship with our social workers and stuff. Too many families in Minnesota have given up on the waiver because they could not afford it. If finances require us to choose this option, Thomas is the one who suffers, and 24-hour care may not be possible. He would go back into a long waiting list where he eventually may receive funding for a group home at 18 to 21 years of age. His development without the stimulation that we are currently providing would slow dramatically. Giving up custody of Thomas is unfortunately another option to consider. Although a parental fee would still be assessed, there would no longer be damage to our home, and we would have a typical household for our 14-year-old. At Thomas's level of functioning, this would cost the state 2 to 5 times what we are receiving in waiver funding. The current sliding fee scale was developed because legislators felt it was unfair that middle-income families such as ours receive substantial benefits for minimum premiums. Does it seem fair that current parental fee calculations put these same families into situations of financial hardship, having to make such tough decisions? In other hearings, I've heard members of the committee ask testifiers, what do you suggest we cut in order to pay for this? In the case of parental fees, you could apply the logic of the parental fee calculation table to your income taxes. The more money you make, the higher percentage of tax you pay. Does that seem fair? Please support reducing parental fees that was enacted in 2003 and modified in 2005. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I think this bill obviously has to go to the Finance Committee. I don't know that it has to go anywhere else. If there's...
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I hear an awful lot about this issue from constituents in my district. And I wonder if you could just offer a brief historical perspective. So in 2003, these fees were increased. I am making the assumption that there was a tie there to some fiscal concerns at the time. If you could confirm that for me. And then I wondered, you're suggesting a $100 deduction. How close does that get to the 2003 levels?
Senator, I'm having Steve Larson come up, but we in 2005 we did reduce the fee some, and you're exactly correct. It was a budget issue. In the budget cuts in 2003, the fees were raised very significantly.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I think Senator Marty answered
if
that
you could
question.
Please,
Steve
you could
Larson
please
with the Arc of Minnesota.
Yourself. Thank you.
Senator Lynch, I think Senator Marty answered that while I was sitting or in the process of sitting down. As far as the fees were increased in 2003 as part of the governor's proposal to help balance the budget. As far as how much the $100 deduction would get back to 2003, I think it would get back part of the way. We'd have to sit down with the Department of Human Services staff and exactly and look at the finances of that and see exactly how far that gets us. But it wouldn't get us all the way.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Marty. I think that might be a calculation worth taking a look at for your next stop.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I agree. The difficulty, as you can see, is the big increase. I mean, I don't know how what percentage-wise this gets us back, but it's been a real sharp hit for people. And again, I always wonder why we should be charging people who have all the extra burdens of me often losing a job in order to take care of a child, why they should be paying that much more to get the coverage. Madam Chair, I will move the bill be recommended.
Any other questions? Okay. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Senator Marty. If not, Senator Marty moves Senate File 711 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator Marty. And I think we have Senator Sharon, but she is not here. She is. Thank you. Welcome, Senator. Yes, we're ready for you. Just on time. This is Senate File 710. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Torres Ray, Marty. Things change so quickly around here. I have an amendment, the A1 amendment,
Senator Sharon has the A1. This is a delete everything amendment?
It is. Well,
Senator Torres-Ray moves the delete everything amendment, put the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. This bill requires the Commissioner of Human Services to seek federal approval to modify the budget methodology for adults who have chosen the consumer-directed community supports option under all developmental disability waivers. The modification that is spoken to in this bill would provide an increase to cover the cost of the services needed when a person is no longer attending school due to a graduation or because of their age. Things change when a person is leaving school. They're no longer supported by the programs within the school system. So it changes then what demands they have in terms of community-based supports that they, if they utilize those, avoid more expensive kinds of care. The cost increase must vary based on the type of the waiver that the person requests and on the cost of the services that are needed for that person during the day. So depending on the acuity or the difficulties or the degree of demand for the needs for services, the adjustment of the costs would be made for the person who's continuing to use the self-directed service. The commissioner must submit a waiver amendment to the federal government by October 1st, 2009 under this legislation. I have with me, would you like us to continue?
Yes, please go ahead if you have any. And Mr. Larson, go ahead.
I have with me Steve Larson. Would you please introduce yourself, Steve?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota. And this is part of our waiting list legislation that we've been promoting for several years now in order to address the needs of the 5,000 people that are on our waiting list. Today, we're particularly highlighting the 500 people that are over 23 years of old that are waiting for a waiver slot and living with elderly parents. And as we put this legislation together this year, knowing the economic environment we are in, we are also looking at ways to be more cost-effective, and the ARC, as well as our allied agencies and consumers, have been advocating for fixing the consumer-directed community support. So this legislation promotes fixing the formula for community-directed community supports so that more individuals can stay on that program. We believe that every individual with intellectual and developmental disabilities or individuals on the waivers should know what their annual budget is, be able to work within the parameters that the state sets up on how that money should be spent, and have great flexibility, and we believe that's one of the solutions to our budget issues this particular year. And so with that, I'd like to, along with the senator, defer to our testifiers on this particular bill.
Thank you. Do you want to call the witnesses in the... Oh, it says Pam Taylor.
Pam Taylor.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. My name is Pam Taylor, and my husband Lou and I have three sons. Our youngest son, Dan, is a young man who was born with Down syndrome. He's 23 years old. We assist Dan to meet his needs by supervising and administering medication, getting out and participating in any social and recreational activities, dressing appropriately since his body does not process temperatures well, which can be a life-threatening condition, and maintaining a skincare routine. In addition, Dan needs ongoing supervision with general aspects of his functional living, such as help with meal preparations. Dan is one of 5,000 Minnesotans on the waiting list for a developmental disabilities waiver. We've been on the list for 5 years now. Our social workers told us that Dan is unlikely to get a waiver unless, for example, one of us were to die. not a very pleasant thought. Dan has a dream that he's talked about continuously since high school. He wants to move out of our house. He wants to have his own life living in the community. And all I can tell him is that we don't have enough money and cannot get any of the supports needed for him to do that. Sometimes the limitations of this situation make him angry and frustrated, and all the time it makes him sad. Dan got a job recently, and he is so proud. Not only is he working and feeling productive, but he's doing what he's wanted to do for so long, clerical work in an office. And parenthetically, I have to tell you that the first day he came home from work and walked in the house, he literally glowed. Despite being a working person now, Dan's income is unlikely either in the short term or in the long term to support community living with the supports necessary to make that successful. What we all want for Dan is to be happy and live a self-determined life. Lou and I are growing older. Our health issues are increasing. We both have arthritis and deteriorating knee joints. We've both had surgery on our knees. I've also had surgery on one hand. I have chronic back problems related to Dan's physical care when he was a child. This is making caring for Dan more difficult every year. We worry about what will happen to him. Making a move to community living in a crisis would be devastating for him. He doesn't do well with crisis, and he does not respond well to unexpected changes. Lou and I ask you to do what is right, to be proactive and help find the necessary funding to increase waiver allotments so that Dan and people like Dan can access the necessary supports to live full lives of their choosing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Ms. Denning, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Murray, and the committee. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to support House File 295, which would restore reasonable financing for my adult son and the consumer-directed community support services. Our recent loss to 54% loss of funding forced us back into licensed services that have never adequately met Jeff's needs, nor is it cost-effective for the services delivered. This bill would be a cost-neutral bill, from my understanding, but a godsend for our family. Thank you for hearing and seriously considering our testimony today. My name is Deborah Denning, and I am here today with my son, Jeff Skork. I'm always honored to assist my son to communicate and help him to provide information that may help others. Jeff has multiple disabilities and a very unique, complicated communication system. Therefore, we have a very unique family challenge for day-to-day living. My son is a remarkable man with an astute mind locked within a body. Jeff is my pride and joy, but he has also posed major challenges for us and professionals for many years. Jeff and I worked together the past few days to put together this testimony, apologizing that his communication device is broken and he cannot speak for himself today. The medical assistance process has held us up for many months in our pursuit of acquisition of a new device to replace his broken one. Please let me introduce you to Jeff.
Your turn.
Jeff has 999 codes in his head, so I will just tell you what he said by looking up 59. Hello, how is it going?
Anything else? No. Can I keep going?
Okay. My mom asked me how I felt about not being able to be on the consumer-directed community support waiver anymore, and how I felt about the budget cuts that we have already endured and that are coming my way. I told her that I was sad and mad. I'm 38 years old and have lived in every possible institutional and licensed service since I was 3.5 years old. It all failed me, and all I ever wanted to do was to move home to live with my family. The consumer-directed community support option finally came to us and gave us a chance to put in place the unique kind of services that I need. We finally had hope. Things were going very well, and I was making a lot of progress with my skills. Then the state took it all away from me, and I'm back to the old license system, missing out on flexibility, options, and so many services that could help me but are no longer financially available, putting a burden on my family and my programs. I want to go back to the consumer-directed community supports waiver so that I can receive the specialty services that I need. Can I keep going? Okay. Mom and I have talked a lot, and I now understand there are going to be more cuts and hurts to my budget, my staff, my family, and my personal financial situation. I just don't understand all of the details, but I do know that what I'm hearing is going to ask me to live with less yet again. No dental coverage, decreased money for personal care staff, and limited access to services. I can't even take a drink or even scratch my nose without staff help. I am totally physically dependent. I want to fight to stop people like me from getting hurt anymore. Every year it's gotten worse. Why we're always the first to take the hits, as if not already vulnerable, is painful. Keep going. To say that investing in education at any level is more important than taking care of the most vulnerable in our state says something about our morality and priorities. To let those of us with significant disabilities lay by the sidelines, left to make do with little to do it with, while you invest in K-12 education and college students, well, my mom and I want to say that while important, some priorities are really out of whack here. We should not have to compete with these other programs. We know that there are difficult decisions to be made, but one that should never even be in the mix is the needs of people like me who are voiceless and the most vulnerable. We shouldn't have to defend ourselves year after year after year. And we seriously wonder why we are so afraid to raise additional revenue to help people like me. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the committee and for considering our opinions. Should you need more information, our family will be more than happy to help.
Thank you, Ms. Denning and Mr. Squire. Thank you. Senator Sharon, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Marty. I would like you to know that we, in the Delete All Amendment, what was eliminated from this bill was some language that I've introduced, I think, every year since all 2 years I've been here.
Every year, all 2 years.
to increase the number of waiver slots. But I deleted that section in this bill because I know that we will have a great deal of difficulty doing what really is needed and what in the long run would save a lot of costs to the healthcare delivery system. But what remains in the bill and what you're being asked to look at here today has to do with consumer-directed community support services. And although I'll have Mr. Larson answer much more complex questions about this, what is persuasive to me about this and what I want you to understand is that students who are in school who are on community-directed community support budgets, when they graduate or they come to a certain age, many of the programs that are in place for those students go away. And under the community support budget methodology, a certain amount of money is removed from the allowance under the consumer support directed program to such a degree that they can't afford any longer to build that menu of services that they need in order to stay in the community and forces them off of what could be a cost-saving program for the state onto a more expensive waiver or institutionalized care. So by changing the methodology by which the person can retain more of the resources under the already existing consumer-directed community support program, they would be able to save money for the state during a time when we're having a tough time by not going on more expensive waiver programs. These other waivers are rigid. They have certain requirements. They're siloed, as we've talked about often. And some of the services fit and don't fit for the person. So you're expending resources for services that may not be necessary. Whereas the consumer-directed program is a more of a menu shopping and can be designed specifically to the needs of the person, and it can be built based on what I call acuity or a level of disability and level of need. So that's what is left in this bill and what is in front of you. And if you have questions about how that works and how that would save money, I would defer your questions to Mr. Larson.
Thank you. Do you want to make any comments at this time? If not, I'll call the Johnsons up next.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Sharon had another committee to get to, so we were passed out their testimony of
okay.
The other people that were going to testify.
Yes, I see Johnsons and Mr. Pekarsky. Okay, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, is this legislation necessary in order that we can apply for the waiver amendment, or how does that all piece together?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, this language is necessary so that the Department of Human Services can make a change in their current budget methodology with CMS, and so this gives them permission to go ahead and recommend that change so that the budget methodology will continue to work for individuals as they transition from children's to adult programs.
Are there questions from the committee? Is there anyone who wanted to speak with concerns about the bill? Is there any discussion? If not, Senator Higgins moves Senate File 710 as amended be recommended pass. And does this one go to the Finance Committee? Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon, and we've gone through the agenda quicker than we normally do. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.